From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made on a train in Poland in the 1940s when a young girl was traveling to find work. She was Jewish, but armed with a fake birth certificate, was pretending to be Catholic. A teenager on the train recognized the girl, saying she remembered her once wearing an armband and a blue Jewish Star of David in a Polish city. The teenager was outraged and confronted the girl, saying she could turn her over to the Gestapo. The girl responded, "What gave you such a preposterous idea?" She stuck to her alias until the teenager eventually backed down and became embarrassed and even friendly. You're hearing part of the remarkable story of Helen Levinson, a Holocaust survivor from Poland. Levinson was on that train leaving Poland and her family. She had already escaped a concentration camp with the help of a Nazi guard who knew her father, but Levinson's family decided it was too dangerous to stay together, so they split up. Levinson traveled alone across Poland, Austria, and Germany, even working for a Nazi, while lying about her name, religion, and family to stay alive. She calls her survival not one miracle, but 1,000. She was the only person in her family to survive. Levinson found her way to Rochester and eventually began sharing her story after her rabbi showed her a book that claimed the Holocaust was just a hoax. Well, now hearing her story is more important than ever as Holocaust survivors age, and as a recent survey reported, many Americans today don't know much about the Holocaust. According to a New York Times report, 41% of Americans and 66% of millennials cannot say what Auschwitz was. Levinson's story is told in a new play called Survivors at the Jewish Community Center. We'll preview the play. We also have the honor of hearing Helen Levinson's story in her own words this hour. It is my honor to have you here, Helen. Thank you for being here. How are you?
Thank you for inviting me.
That's great to have Helen. And Helen is portrayed in Survivors by Alexa Scott Flaherty, who is, I think, just meeting Helen in person for the first time?
That's right.
Is this a thrill for you?
It's a huge thrill and honor. And I've watched Helen's tapes on the Jewish Federation has an archive, and I've watched her speak for the first time I've seen her live.
Well, look what the show's called Connections, Alexa. And look what we are making here this hour. Thank you for being here. It's nice to have
you.
Thank you. And Freda Schneider is the director of Tykes at the Jewish Community Center and co-producer of Survivors, which is making its world premiere at the JCC this coming Tuesday at 7 p.m. It's one night only. Freda, welcome. Why don't you tell us a little bit more about Survivors?
Well, as you said, you know what? It is becoming less and less possible for Holocaust survivors to tell their stories, and less and less possible for them to visit schools and kind of give that education to our next generation. And as a result, just what you talked about, those startling statistics about how our kind of public consciousness about the Holocaust is dwindling. And so I think it's more important now than ever that we keep that memory alive and keep that information flowing for generations to come. And so we looked for a play that we could bring to middle schools, because the New York State curriculum for eighth grade requires Holocaust education, but doesn't give a lot of sort of detail or specification about in what way to provide that education. So we thought, hey, let's do it with theater. And we just weren't able to find exactly the play that we were looking for. And we decided the best way to find the exact play that we're looking for is to create it ourselves. So we commissioned a fantastic playwright from L.A. named Wendy Kaut to write the story of 10 local Holocaust survivors. So 10 people who, after the war, came, relocated to Rochester, and we sort of wove their story together into this play called Survivors.
So this coming Tuesday, again, 7 p.m. at the JCC, one night only, one chance to...
That's correct.
So get tickets where?
You can get tickets by calling the JCC at 461-2000 or by going online to jcccenterstage.org, or you can come to the JCC at 1200 Edgewood Avenue in Brighton and buy tickets in person. And they're going fast.
Well, before we listen to Helen in her own words, I just want to ask Alexa what you hope the audience takes from your performance this coming Tuesday.
Well, I think one of the things that's so special, this play was designed for young people, and all of the people in the story are young at the time that this happened. So I think it's an amazing experience to look and see people just like you who were going through something so intense, something that could have happened to you, and to actually be able to connect that these are real people, that this really happened, that we are living in a time where we are seeing a rise in hate again, and that this could happen again. And one of the special messages in this play is that if it weren't for the people who were not Jewish, who stepped up and took risks themselves because they felt it was important to stand up against hate, many, many of these people would have not been able to survive.
Helen, you were born in Poland, the youngest of three children.
Yes.
And I'm reading that you thought of your younger self as a little Shirley Temple?
Yes. I had curly hair, black curly hair. I was very ready to perform all the time. And I had a cute little voice, and my sister used to teach me all the kinds of songs from operettas. So every time I walked up the stairs, one of the neighbors would open up the door and say, they used to call me Lenchen. Lenchen, come here. Sing something for me. Sing me of us four. That's what they would say in German. I didn't care. They put me on a chair and I sang. And I was just very nimble, and I could have really been a little Shirley Temple of black girls.
So think about this little girl, vivacious, full of energy, happiness, singing, life. Last name, by the way, and then think about Helen's sense of humor. Your last name, you like to say, was pronounced by sneezing once and coughing twice.
Yes.
What was your last name?
My last name was Przysusker. That's sneeze once, Przysusker. Cough twice, and you got it.
Przysusker.
Przysusker.
Just like it's spelled, which I will not read here. And I know your father was a brewer, and I know it's difficult, but I wanted to offer the audience, the listeners, a chance to understand the vivaciousness of your childhood and juxtapose that with just the horrors of the Holocaust, because I still can't believe we have a world where people could deny this happened or don't understand the scope and the scale that it happened. What do you remember about when it started to happen?
Well, when it started to happen, people did not believe, because some people would come back and say, you know, you're going to a concentration camp and they're going to kill you. And my mother would say, no, that's not true. The Germans, don't you know the Germans? They're intelligent people, educated people. They're not killers. My goodness. And many of the Jews would not believe that. But then at the end, they told my father to gather his family and go to Majdanek concentration camp just for work. That's what they kept saying. And, of course, the sign above the gate of the concentration camp said, Arbeit macht frei. That means work makes free. And they kept hiding it. Everything was done with special purpose, so people would go with their whole family to a concentration camp. But when they told my father that, he said, oh, sure, I will go with the family. But inwardly, he said to us, never. If they want to kill us, let them kill us on the streets of the city with a bullet. We don't have to go to a concentration camp to get killed. And what we're going to do is we're going to separate, and maybe one of us will survive. And that's exactly what happened. I have no idea what happened to my mother and sister, who was 14 years older than I. And my brother was going together with a cousin who my father saved from the army because they were putting a machine gun at them, at soldiers, Polish soldiers. So they usually separated the Jews from the Catholics. And he asked my father, could he please requisition him to work in a brewery? And that's what he did. And from that time on, he was working in a brewery. He was an excellent cabinet maker. So he was doing barrels or repairing barrels, and he lived with us. My brother and him were both in the army. They survived the army. They fought for Poland. And they thought, well, they're going to join the partisans. Now, the partisans are working against Germany, And they thought they'd get to those. I found out afterwards that the partisans around Lublin were very anti-Semitic. So I assume that my cousin and my brother were killed by them. It was all a thing of hatred. Everybody hated everybody. That was the terrible, terrible thing. And you were a Jew, you were hated. It could be a good Jew, could be a bad Jew, could be anybody, but you were hated. And that's, many of the Polish people felt that way. There were some, though, like the mother of a dear little girlfriend of mine who was sitting with me in class in the same table. She loved me like her own daughter. I would go to her house and play with her. I even would help her decorate the Christmas tree. Well, my father didn't know about it. He was a religious Jew, but I didn't tell him about it, so I didn't have to lie about it. But she just loved me, and she said, Helenka, you'll never survive in Poland. You have to go to Germany to work. And they used to catch a lot of Polish women and young girls, and without any question, sent them off to Germany to work. So she is the one that told me she'll take me to the train station because in Lublin I shouldn't put myself up for work because they may recognize me. So I went with her early in the morning. She hid me overnight in a shed, and early in the morning she risked her life, went to the train station, bought me a ticket to Rozwadów, I remember, which was a city nearby Lublin, and I took the ticket, pretended to be a Christian, and I knew everything that Christians do. I knew how to cross myself. I knew that I had to go to the priest to give my sins, and then afterwards to get a little peace on my tongue, which was communion. And I knew all those things, and I really tried to be a Christian. So I got to Rozwadów, and there it was very difficult to find the place where the station was because anybody that would ask about it would be suspicious. So I thought, well, there were a lot of Gestapo on the station. So I thought a little old man was standing there with the suitcases. I says, well, I'll have to take my chance and talk to him. So I talked to him, and I said, gee, by any chance would you know where the station is here, where you can put yourself up for work to Germany? He says, oh, my God, you don't going to go to Germany to work, are you? I says, well, I thought of it. So he said, my God, a lovely Polish girl like you, you come home with me to my wife, and she'll love to have you. I says, okay, just tell me where it is. I'll take a look and see how the place looks, and if I don't like it, I'll be back. Sure enough, he told me where the station was, and I went up there. I had a Polish birth certificate in which my name was Christina Helena Czerniakowska, and that was the name my father said I had to remember, nothing else, always that. And I went with my little birth certificate, and actually the birth certificate was of a child that already died. So if the Gestapo ever got a hold of me, all they needed to do is call up the church that the child was active in, and they would have told her that the child is no more. And they would have known immediately that I was a Jew and would have shot me. But luckily, I didn't get into the hands of a Gestapo. So I put myself up for work to Germany. I said, my parents are dead. The partisans killed them, and I may just as well go to the world. I'd like to see the world. I'll go and I'll work. I'll gladly go to Germany. So they put me up in a room with a lot of other girls, and I was a Christian girl by the name of Christina Helena Czerniakowska. And in fact, there was one little girl who became friends with me, and she said, you know what, Helenka? I told them to call me Helen because I didn't like Christina. I was afraid that somebody will call me Christina, I won't answer. I was very, very smart for my age. I was only 14 years old. And she said, you know, I'm going to Berlin because I have a relative in Berlin, and we could be in touch with each other. I said, I'd gladly go to Berlin. And she was so happy. As we stood up at a table afterwards, where they would assign us to go to where they were going to send us to go to work, she was standing right next to me, and they said, well, you're going to Berlin, right? She said, yes. And she looked at me, and she said, and you're going to Vienna. And I says, well, I don't want to go to Vienna. I want to go to Berlin. She says, are you going to give me trouble? I says, no, if I have to go to Vienna, I'll go to Vienna, gladly. And sure enough, they assigned me to Vienna. I said goodbye to that girl. She was very sad that I couldn't go with her. And they shipped me off to Vienna. And in the place where they assign you to go to work, it was very funny because people would look you up and down. I thought of my father telling me, when you try to buy a horse, you have to look at the open up the mouth of the horse and look at the teeth. I says, are you going to do that with me too? But they didn't. Unfortunately, there was a guy who looked like a Gestapo man. He was dressed in the uniform with a big sign of the Hakenkreuz, the thing. And I said, oh my God, I'm going to these people to work? Yeah, sure enough, he took me to a street called Neue Weltgasse, and they lived on the third floor. And the lady, his wife, was pretty nice. I worked all day long. And one day, I happened to go. It was already cold. It was already almost November. And in Poland, that's very bad time. And also in Vienna, it was very cold. And they had already snow. So we went to on a little sled. We had the other two kids. We had several kids. And the younger girl that was probably a little older than I, the two of us were pulling the sled. And while we were pulling and going home, she told me, you know what, we have a real tough time keeping our help. It seems every 2 weeks somebody else tries to say that they cannot do the work. And before I went away from the place where they assigned me to go to work, they told me that because I was, they called it in German, minderjährig, that means below the age of work, really, that I can, if the work is too hard, I can come back and they will assign me someplace else. So when she told me that they're leaving work all the time to help, I wasn't afraid anymore to do the same thing. So in the evening, I talked to I can't call him a gentleman because he was a real Nazi, but I spoke to him and said to him, please, the work here is a little bit too difficult for me. Why don't you take me tomorrow morning to the Arbeitersamt and I'll go to a different place to work. Oh, he was furious with me. He called me a Polish swine. And I thought to myself, I was crying, but I thought to myself, if you'd only know who I really am. Anyhow, he took me to the place of work. And they did assign me to a different household. And the guy was not, I don't think he was a Nazi. He was a young man, not, well, to me everything was old. There was 40, but probably in that age. And he said, you're going to come with me to my beautiful neighborhood in Vienna. It was Grinzing, which is really a lovely neighborhood. And I was working on Formanegasse, which was a beautiful villa. And I didn't even realize that I had to take care of the whole villa. Well, I worked like a little horse. I got up 5 o'clock in the morning, and because they didn't have a vacuum cleaner in those days, I had to take a brush and a little shovel, be on my knees, and clean all the carpets that way. Well, my knees are still feeling it. They were swollen for a long time, but today I have rheumatic stuff in my knees because I have a problem walking. But I worked, and they treated me pretty good, I must say. But I had to work very, very hard. And there was a son in the family who one time I accompanied him to a movie. And apparently the German youth found out about it, and they sent him a letter and told him, you had your son go with a Polish worker to the movie. You can't do that ever again. So I wasn't able to accompany him anymore. But everything was fate. And one time, the lady of the house, who was usually pretty nice to me, all of a sudden got up early. That was about 7 o'clock. I was sitting down in the kitchen and having a little piece of bread and coffee, hot coffee. And she came down yelling at me that she doesn't know where her jewelry is. Now, her jewelry were all diamonds. And usually they were standing in a beautiful little dish on her desk in a special room. And she says, where are my diamonds? Where are my jewelry? I says, well, I don't know, but they must be in that room. And because I didn't get up to go looking for it, she took the coffee and poured it to my face. Well, that wasn't a very good experience, but she had different personality. Sometimes she was furious, and this is when she was furious, and sometimes she was very nice. I ran upstairs to the husband who was in the bathroom, and I just knocked on the door. I said, I want to tell you something. Your wife just, because I didn't run to look for her jewelry, she poured a cup of hot coffee in my face. Do you think that should be done? He didn't answer me, and then all of a sudden he said to me, well, if you don't like it here, I have a better place for you. There are some camps around Vienna, and I can put you in that camp so you won't have my wife pouring coffee on you. Well, I knew what he meant, that he's going to put me in a concentration camp. And I said, well, no, thank you very much. And I went away. I could see that I couldn't get anything from him that would resemble any understanding. But I made pretend that she didn't do that, and I kept on doing whatever I was supposed to do until the war came. And the war with us was a lot of bombing. I was the one that was the camel of the family. I had all the blankets in front of me and a huge rucksack, a thing in the back of me with a lot of food. And it was very tough to run to a place where you had to hide from the bombs, because it was down the steps for about 2 flights in a wine cellar. But I didn't mind. I had to run. And I thought, well, if something happens, at least I have a lot of food on my back. And I have blankets to cover myself up with. But I did. The lady that in Poland that has taught me a lot about the Catholic religion gave me a little Polish prayer book, which I took with me and I have to this day. And she also gave me a rosary. But the rosary I must have lost when I was running with the blankets, because I don't have the rosary anymore. And that's how I survived the war, working very hard. Then the Russians came in, and I heard terrible things about the Russians, that all the women are subjected to being raped. And since I was not a woman but a little girl, I had no idea what they're going to do to me. I thought I better get away from the villa, because in the big houses they wouldn't do that. They were afraid there were too many people there. So individual Russian soldiers would go out to the villas and do whatever they wanted. I took a few pieces of my luggage, and I ran to a seamstress who I acquainted in the house. She came to sew many things, and she said, Helenka, if you ever are in trouble, come to me. And I went to a big house on the 13th floor she lived, and I stayed there for a couple weeks, and it was wonderful. No Russians ever touched me. And then a friend of mine saw me, there was an acquaintance in the bomb shelter, told me to come to her. And that's where I lived the rest of the war, actually, in a bombed-out house. I had only 3 walls in my room. One room was down. One wall was down completely, and the guy that was taking care of the house put up a wooden wall for me with a big window in it. Didn't have to put a window in. It was all open, but it was already May. So I was not afraid I'm going to freeze. And they put a little bed in there, and that's how I lived until I got to a school where I would learn how to type in shorthand because I had to earn some money for myself. And that's what I did. And I also asked the people, I did get a violin, and I got a three-quarter size violin because I had been playing violin before and studying all the time. So I thought maybe I'd get taken by a school in Vienna. And sure enough, I practiced every night. They told me that I could close the office and that I could practice there. So I practiced as well as I could. And then I went to the school, to Vienna Conservatory. And the professor that interviewed me said that my tones were very, very good, and I was very good in playing, but my bowing was atrocious. I didn't realize that I did not keep the bow in the right spot. So he got a special girl for me. It must have been one that was already ready to graduate, and she was teaching me about bowing, and I was so thrilled with that. But I was going to the Vienna Conservatory and studying there when I had given my name and everything to different newspapers because I wanted to find family. I didn't know any family. I knew I had family in America because those were the sisters of my mother and brothers. And I also had family in Israel, which wasn't Israel then. It was Palestine. These were the family of my father. And I thought by giving my name to all the papers and telling them who I was, somebody may see it. Sure enough, there was a person that saw in the paper Aufbau, a German paper, they saw my name, and they contacted a Mr. Fromm, who was a good friend of my family and of me, too, when I was a little girl, about 3 or 4. I knew that he emigrated to New York in 1938 from East Prussia, where I first was as a little girl. I was raised in East Prussia. That's why I knew my German was flawless. My sister was teaching me all the time German, too. And sure enough, this one gentleman, I even remember his name was Mr. Thalhammer. He called my friend, Mr. Fromm, and said, somebody's looking for you. And the minute that he saw my name, he says, oh, das Lenchen, she's alive. And he knew my aunt, that's my mother's younger sister, was living right across the street from St. Paul Street on Ariel Park. He ran to her to tell her that I was alive. And so my aunt immediately telegraphed to New York City to tell my aunts and uncles that I'm asking for them. And sure enough, just about a year later, in December, I received notice that I should be coming to America because my professor was very angry with me. He says, you'll never get the education that you would get here. But I couldn't help it. I wanted family very badly because I had no family at all. I knew that my mother and father would not be alive anymore, and I didn't think my sister or my brother would be alive. So I really had no one. And when they told me that I have family, I was absolutely thrilled. And they said they sent me an affidavit. My uncle was a furrier on Fifth Avenue, so he had the money. And I was going to go in January. I started to travel to America. And I also asked for people to send me papers. I did not want to go without papers on leaky boats and go to another camp. I said, hey, I have to go only with papers, otherwise I don't go anyplace. And sure enough, on the day that I was leaving for America, the papers came from Israel. So it was fate that I came to America. And I stayed with my aunt, and of course, I met my husband by being sent from the Jewish Federation to a camp because I was studying very hard. I was in high school. I had to finish high school first before I could go to the Eastman School of Music. So I went
That was Camp Seneca Lake, right? The JCC.
It was Camp Seneca Lake, that's right. And there I met my husband, my future husband, of course. He spoke some words of Polish with me. Meant nothing to me. It was all broken words that he said to me that he learned from his father, because his father had a store in a Polish neighborhood. So it was like candles, herring. They had absolutely nothing to do with each other. I says, what are you trying to say? He says, well, I learned some Polish from my father. And he found out that I was Polish. Apparently, I looked good enough to him to date me, because I was quite cute, with real red cheeks and red lips, and never put any makeup on me, and beautiful dark locks. I had curly hair going down to my shoulders. And apparently, he liked my looks because he wanted to date me. But he was going on a trip to California first. And I said, well, I'll never hear from him, I'm sure. Anyhow, I got a card from California from Stanley Levinson. And my mother said, who is this? My aunt said that to me. And I became a little red. And I says, well, I'm sure you don't know him. I met him in camp. He says, I don't know him. Maybe I do. Tell me the name. And I said, Stanley Levinson. I says, who says I don't know him? Of course I know him. So she was very good friends with his grandmother. And when I first came from Europe, she took me to his grandmother to talk to her in Yiddish, because I didn't know English at all, but I did know Yiddish. So I met the grandmother before I even knew that she was the grandmother of Stanley Levinson. Stanley wanted to get in touch with me, and he did, and we started to date. And when, for Passover, I was invited to his uncle, who was Morris Levinson, who was in charge of all the star markets, I was invited to his house for Passover, for the Seder, and it was starting to be a little serious. So around May, he asked me to marry him. And I agreed. He was very young, and I was very young. I think I was just 18, just graduated high school, really, a year before. And I must have been already 19. I don't remember. But anyhow, we were getting married that same year in September. And that's what happened. I married Stanley Levinson. And afterwards, I'd never touched the violin again, because I went to Eastman School of Music because I got a scholarship there too, but it only lasted for about 6 months, because they told me I have to have about $400 in order to finish, and then I'd be able to play at the Philharmonic, so I'd be able to make a little money at the end of the Philharmonic. Usually they put real good students at the end of the Philharmonic, and then I would earn some money. So I went to my uncle in New York City, who I think had money because he was a furrier on Fifth Avenue. And I put my pride in my pocket, and I asked my Uncle Harry, please, would you lend me $400? Because with that, I could graduate. I needed another 2 years to go to school, to music school. And he says, darling, you're much too pretty. You're going to get married, and my money's going to be lost. Well, what chance did I have? I put the violin away and never touched it again, because I didn't want to become just a fiddler. I wanted to be good at it. I wanted to be a good philharmonic fiddler.
You haven't played it since?
Pardon?
You haven't played it since?
I haven't played since, no, and I will never play again, because violin is something I had to practice 6 hours a day when I went to the Eastman School of Music. And if you don't touch it, you lose your touch. And it sounds like a cat meowing when you first take the violin, because you lose your touch. And I didn't want to do that. So my violin is still sleeping. Yes.
Helen, I don't want to interrupt you. What I want to remind our listeners what you're hearing is Helen Levinson, who is, well, we're claiming her as a Rochesterian now. Helen is one of fewer than half a million living Holocaust survivors, and she's 88 years old, and she is having her story told as part of a new play at the Jewish Community Center this coming Tuesday. It's called Survivors, the story of 10 survivors, and Helen's story is one of them. And this remarkable woman is played by Alexis Scott Flaherty, who's here with us, and Freda Schneider, who's co-producer of Survivors. It's at 7 p.m. this coming Tuesday, one night only, at the JCC. And then if you missed it earlier, Freda mentioned that afterwards you're going to take it to schools?
That's right. This is intended to be a tour show that we can bring to middle schools or high schools all around this greater Rochester area. And also school groups can come to see us at the JCC. And we're eager to work with schools to make dates that are convenient for as many students as we can to hear this important story of really what happens when hate becomes normalized.
Yeah. Alexa, what, as a performer, listening to Helen tell her story in remarkable detail, I mean, Helen seems to remember everything and that was happening at the time of the Holocaust, what happened to her family, what happened in different places. For yourself as a performer, what are you sort of taking in as you hear her tell the story that you're going to be portraying on Tuesday night?
Honestly, it's right now I feel kind of, I mean, here I have, I've been playing you in rehearsals and we've done a couple of shows at schools. And the story on its own before I even met you moves me, and at different points in the play is, it's hard to say. And sitting here, I feel like weeping, really. It's just what you went through and the strength and bravery of the choices that you made moment by moment. And there's stuff in your story that I watched on the Federation's website, that these little tiny choices you had to make in a second to protect yourself. It's just so moving and so inspiring. And one of the things that is so incredible about this particular play, I think, is that it takes these real stories and all it does is change them just a little bit to weave them together so that it's still your stories as opposed to some other new story. And so of the 10 survivors in this story, only 3 are still living. And for all of us, 4 are living. For all of us, it's so meaningful to tell your stories, and we just hope that we're honoring your real lives.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Well, I'm talking. I have spoken to many, many classes. There are thousands of children. And I'm talking mainly about hatred, how very, very terrible hatred is. And I want the children to know what happens when you hate. And I want, like I many times say when I start to talk, that I wish that we could just take that word out of the dictionary, cross it out altogether. Because hatred is a terrible disease. Actually, when you hate, you hurt more yourself than the other people. You just don't feel right to hate somebody. Like in Poland, for example, there were some Polish people who would give away, even though they were Poles themselves, Christians themselves, if a Christian Pole hit a Jew, they would gladly go to a Gestapo man and point out where the Jew was hiding, and they knew that not only the Jew was going to be killed, but the whole Christian family. How can you be a Christian and do that? I always wondered about that. But there were some Poles who were so full of hatred that they gladly did that.
But Helen, can I ask you, you know, as you think about your own survival, and you may never know what happened to some of your family members, but you don't seem to have much doubt that they died in the Holocaust.
Definitely.
Do you hate Nazis?
Well, I can't say that I love Nazis. I don't hate Germans, because I feel that the country is now with young kids who don't even know what the Nazis were. I feel that they're different people now. They're not the Nazis that we knew. I would not be able to get across a person that called themselves Nazi, because the Nazis that I knew were heartless people. They were horrible people. I would say even a beast has more feeling than the Nazis had. That's what I would say. Horrible, horrible people, and they were ingrained. They were full of hatred, and they could do whatever they wanted to do with human beings. And many times it wasn't very pretty to see what they did with them.
Helen, but do you have any fear that there is a modern resurgence of Nazism?
I do have fear, and that's why I'm talking, because I hear about hatred in Europe, and sometimes I even feel that some of it is gone over to this country. Some of it is not very pretty, but that's the reason I keep on talking. I'm going to be talking until the day I die, because I want the children to realize how terrible hatred is, that it can happen to anyone, anyone. You can hate the Christian religion just like you hated the Jewish religion, and you can hate black people just like you hated the Jews. Hatred is just all over. You've got to warn yourself. I always tell the children, if you join a group and you see that they are talking about hatred, immediately drop out of it. Don't go to a group that says hatred, because that's the worst thing in the world you could do.
I want to read, once again, I want to remind our listeners what the New York Times reported back in April about some recent surveys of Americans and the lack of understanding of the Holocaust. 31%, again, according to the New York Times reporting on various surveys, 31% of Americans and 41% of millennials believe that 2 million or fewer people who were Jewish were killed in the Holocaust. The actual number is around 6 million. 41% of Americans and 66% of millennials cannot say what Auschwitz was. 52% of Americans wrongly think that Hitler came to power by force. And, of course, Holocaust denial remains rare in this country. You see it. 96% of American respondents say they believe that the genocide happened. You'd like to talk to the 4%, of course. But, you know, as we see, you know, as time passes, there are fewer living survivors. And Helen's story is so important. What the JCC is doing here is so important to preserve these stories, to make sure we hear them. Helen, when you tell us these stories, you remember these details very vividly, clearly. I mean, there's...
It was ingrained in my soul.
Mm-hmm.
Everything that I lived through is just me. I know, and I thank God have still a mind, even though I'm way up in age, but I feel that it's very important that I remember all these details. I must say that many of the children answer me by writing me a letter, and you know that some of the letters make me cry. They are just so understanding. Children come up to me and they hug me and to tell me they're so happy that I remained alive. And as my father said, when I said goodbye to him, he gave me that birth certificate he got from a priest. And he said to me, you've got to be Christian now. You cannot be Jewish. And just remember that you are a Christian now, and always remember the Christian name. And you also have to remember what hatred has done to you. And he told me, he says, if by any chance you should survive, my chances were nil, really, tell everybody what happened here. And this is what I'm doing. I'm doing my father's wish, who was a wonderful person. He was a brewer, but he also had a heart of gold, because when the Poles came to the brewery, like the Polish people that were bringing the ice in big wagons, they brought usually either butter or something to eat. And he would divide it among all the workers. My mother would say, "It's only a little tiny piece of butter. What are you going to do with it?" He says, "I'm going to divide it among the workers." That's all. The workers did not realize what kind of a person he was, mm-hmm. really. And I remember that when I went to the brewery in 92, one of the brewers treated me like I was his relative. Very nice man. And he said to me, "You know, when the workers, two workers, were burying your father near a fence, there was a fence in the brewery, and the German that was standing there said, 'Oh, yeah, that's the way he should be buried. It's like a dog buried near a fence.' And one of the workers spoke up and said, 'But he's not a dog. He's a human being.' And for that, he got 3 years of heavy work, and he never made it out of there. That shows you how the Germans were taught. He is a dog, so he should be buried like a dog. And the poor guy said, no, but he's not a dog. He's a human being. Yeah. And for that, he got 3 years of heavy labor.
Powerful, powerful words from Helen about hate this hour. And if you don't mind, I'd like to take a phone call. One of our listeners has a question for you. This is Herman calling from Brighton. Go ahead, Herman.
Hi. Helen mentioned that you mentioned that you were born in East Prussia. My father was born in Königsberg, East Prussia, and my grandfather was the rabbi there. Now, my father was much older than you, but where were you born? And are you by any chance?
I was born in Poland, which is a city right next to Germany, next to East Prussia. It's about a half a kilometer from the border. I was born there because my mother had gone to visit her uncle, and I just arrived a little bit too early. So I was born in Poland, but then they took me back to Allenstein, which was my city. That's where I got raised as a little girl, Allenstein, East Prussia. And my father would go to Königsberg to get himself educated into how to make the German beer, the German way. So we lived for quite a while in Allenstein. And, of course, then my father got word that he's going to be arrested, so he disappeared. He went to his father's home. And after a while, we followed him. And we went to Horzel, C-H-O-R-Z-E-L-L, Horzele. That's what the name of the little town. That's where I lived with my grandfather to start with. But I didn't know Polish at all. I only knew German. And my sister was teaching me German all through the time that I shouldn't forget it. And I know how to read and write German, and I'm very proud of it. Now I know, of course, also how to read and write English. And I also knew how to read and write Yiddish. So I was sort of several languages. Languages did not come too difficult for me. I learned Polish very fast. And English I had to learn within a half a year. So because I was from the 11th grade, they put me right in the 12th grade. In the 12th grade, I had to know English. So I studied day and night. I really put a lot of work into my English. And I happened to have a very wonderful teacher. Her name was Miss Thompson. And she was in charge of the English department. And I think thanks to her, I know the English that I know because she gave me a lot of special compositions to write. And one of the compositions even appeared in the newspaper in Benjamin Franklin. That's where I went to. And one of my friends said, my gosh, I've been going through school all these years and know English well, and my articles don't go into the newspaper. Yours do. I said, well, I can't help it. They asked me to put it in the paper. So,
Herman, did we get to your question, though? I'll let you follow up briefly. Go ahead, Herman.
Well, I was just wondering if she or her family would have happened to have any connections with the Jewish community in Königsberg, where my grandfather was the rabbi and my father.
I'm sure my father, my mother, my sister, probably brother knew, but I was only a little girl then. I was only 3-4 years old, so I didn't know much about the synagogue. I knew the prayers because I studied the prayers, but otherwise, no, I would not know them. My parents may have known it because my father was very well versed in Hebrew, and he knew all the prayers, and he would always been asked to read from the Torah. So I knew he was very well versed in the Hebrew. But I didn't know a thing. When I escaped, I was only 14 years old. So how much does one know when we escaped from Germany? I was about either 3 or 4 years old. A little girl. I wouldn't know, but I'm very happy that you called and tell me that you were from East Prussia, because I knew East Prussia, Allenstein, very well, and I loved it there. We went back when we went on a trip to Poland. We went back to Allenstein, too. But now it's called Olsztyn, and the Poles don't even want to say a word in German. I didn't even know the street where I lived. I knew the name of the street was Langegasse. They couldn't tell me which Langegasse was. So I couldn't even see the house that I lived in. That's how very much they're not beloved, the Germans, in the Polish country. Mm. The Poland is now stretching all the way to the Baltic. That's where Poland once was. So that was my time in Allenstein. But German I still know.
Well, Herman, thank you. You can see Helen's story on this coming Tuesday night. We're down about our last minute and a half, and so I just wanted to first say to Helen, thank you for sharing your story in such remarkable detail. It's so important to us.
Thank you for having me on. I'm glad to speak on your station.
And we'll see the story this coming Tuesday night. So in our last minute, just let me ask for maybe 30 seconds apiece from you. You know, Helen's talking about hate. I think about my six-year-old son when he says to me, what was slavery? And having to try to explain to a child who just wants to love everyone what the world has done. Do you hope these performances like Survivors on this coming Tuesday at the JCC do a small measure in maybe making the world to avoid this in the future, Freda?
You know, as Helen was talking, what I kept coming back to in my mind was the idea that hatred was learned. These Nazi soldiers learned to behave the way they behaved. They weren't born that way. It was a learned behavior. And I think what we are trying to accomplish with Survivors is to provide that education, because just as hate can be learned, so too can acceptance.
Wonderful. Alexa, some final thoughts from you.
Just to piggyback on what Freda's saying, we did do two performances of this show for young people. And many, many people raised their hands and said that they had experienced moments of hatred in their own schools, little comments that people said, and said, what could they do to prevent those moments? And so I think helping them find a voice to speak up.
Thank you for the work that you're doing with this. So once again, our thanks to Helen Levinson and the show, Survivors, One Time Only for the Public, this coming Tuesday, 7 p.m. at the JCC. By the way, June 12th also marks the birthday of Anne Frank. It's going to be a powerful evening at the JCC. JCCRochester.org for tickets right now. And Freda, thank you as the co-producer of the show. Good luck with the Tuesday and to all the schools you take it to. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Alexa, you got a heavy duty portraying this wonderful woman.
Yes.
I know you will carry it well. Thank you.
Thank you.
And Helen again.
Thank you.
Our thanks to John Andrus, engineer, and Megan Mack, producer. I'm Evan Dawson. Have a nice afternoon. We're back with you tomorrow on Member Supported Public Radio.